All right.
As I was saying before some people came in, I decided that for today I'd make an exception to my usual policy and use PowerPoints, because some of the stuff that I'm doing with statistics is better done with pictures, and or at least with written text, and my handwriting is terrible, and my artistic ability is a little worse than my handwriting, so I'll use this instead. And so, hope I can figure out how this thing works, but we'll see. Anyway, so if you think about statistics, there are really two different things that are going on, and that you have to sort of pay attention to. And one of them is how you learn stuff. And at the simplest level, that's ways of summarizing data. If you say the statement, the average height of men in Japan has gone up by 6 inches in the last 30 years, which for all I know could be true, is a much easier statement to make than 30 years ago, the distribution of heights among men was so many below 5 feet, so many between 5 feet and 5'1", 5'1 to 5'2", and so forth. If you tried to give the full description of the distribution, that wouldn't add much to the information. It would be a whole lot more complicated. So one of the things you want to do is to find simple but informative ways of summarizing data. But the other more interesting thing, I guess, is trying to find out what's true. So that part of that is spotting patterns. There exists certain sorts of statistical software whose purpose is to figure out what the pattern is, to basically view your data in a bunch of different ways in order that if there is some relationship that occurs, you will sort of show up in the data and you can then go further. And also a lot of what's called hypothesis testing, where you have some guess about a relationship in the real world and you use statistics to try to get some information about whether or not that guess seems to be true or not. So the data points at the first chunk is, as it were, all we would be doing in an honest world. You, however, are going to be lawyers, and you, therefore, are not living in an honest world. And you ought to pay attention to the other half, which is how to convince people of things that you want them to believe. And you have to pay attention to them at the very least so that other people don't convince you and your clients and the jury that is trying the case of things that aren't true that you don't want them to believe. So that part of it, there's a book which actually our kids read when they were fairly young and liked called How to Lie with Statistics. And what it's really about is how not to be fooled by other people lying to statistics. And that's a very useful skill. But if you think about, I was thinking about that driving in here, about examples of ways in which you use data to persuade people. And what I was imagining was that somebody sues a firm on the grounds that it's engaged in sex discrimination, that it underpays women. And the attorney for the plaintiff says the average wage of women in this firm is only 90% of the average wage of men in this firm. And imagine that you are the attorney for the defense. How might you try to look at the data to see if you could find a way of summarizing the data that may look better for your client? What sort of questions might you ask? Because the implicit argument is the reason it is 90% as much is that the firm discriminates against women. Yeah? One thing you might do is to say, well, that's perfectly true. But in category X of the firm, which is sort of the least skilled, educated, etc., men and women make the same amount. It's just there are more women in that. Whereas of the top level executives, they're all overwhelmingly men and they get paid higher. Now, of course, you'd be a little worried that if you made that argument, that the other attorney would say, "Well, that's all very well, but why do you think it is that your high-level positions are all men and your low positions are all women?" And you might then want to... Yep?
I want to make that point. There is relatively few data points.
That would be one interesting thing. That's right. If you only hire 3 women, then just by chance, it's unlikely you'll have the same average wage. What else might you look at? Yep? Well, maybe they're all discriminating. Right? I mean, that would be... No, I was thinking of other things along the lines of what you're saying, except for things which were less vulnerable to that counterattack. And one very simple question would be how long people have been working for us. So you might say, let's not compare men to women. Let's compare men in their first 5 years of employment to women in their first 5 years. Men in the next 10 and so forth. And then you might plausibly enough say, even, they could say, well, that's because you fire the women after a little while. Doesn't seem terribly likely. And in particular, it could easily be the case, say, but look, in this industry, 30 years ago, there were practically no women working in this industry. So we had no women working in this industry. So therefore, fine, go sue the woman 30 years ago if you think they were discriminating. That's up to you. But in our situation, therefore, our women workers tend, on the whole, to be less experienced than our male workers. Of course, it might not be true. What I'm suggesting is ways you could look at the data where what you're trying to do is to find whatever pattern of data best supports the case you're making. And if it doesn't work for a number of years' work, you can say, what about education? Maybe it's that we're hiring, you know, engineers and you know, PhD chemists as men, and we're hiring girls out of high school or something. That would, again, be a way of looking at it. But the real point I'm making is only that this sort of tension between trying to find out the truth, which is sort of nice to know, and trying to find out what way of showing the data will best make your argument. And that latter includes both what I would describe as fraudulent and as honest but loaded ways of doing it. So it would seem to me if you can accurately report that men with the same women and men who have the same educational background get the same wage, that's a real argument. Although, of course, somebody else might find a different way of analyzing the data that didn't look so good. On the other hand, we'll be discussing in the course of the class ways in which you can actually distort your presentation of the data, as it were, to do things where you honestly don't really believe what you're saying, but you have a reason to look at somebody else. Well, and even if you were too honest to do that yourself, you better know that you're going to be doing it. All right. So descriptive statistics are sort of the very simplest level, and those are ways of summing up data. And it's worth realizing that even those are loaded in the sense that different ways of summing up the data may give you different results for a reason not always obvious. So people understand the difference between a mean and a median, yes or no. The mean is you sum whatever the things are and divide by the numbers. So if you say the mean height in this room, add up the height of all of us, and there are, I think, 10 of us in the room at the moment, so divide by 10, that would be the mean height. The median height is the height such that half the people are taller and half the people are shorter than that. Those are both measures. Those are both sometimes called average, and they are both sometimes useful measures, but they're different. And notice that, let's start with my first case. Suppose we've got a bunch of cubicle cardboard boxes, and one of them is 1 foot by 1 foot, 2 foot by 2 feet, and so forth, up to 5 feet by 5 feet, which is a refrigerator box, something big. Maybe a small desk came in it. And the question is, what's the average height, width, and depth of a box? And what's the answer to that question? Average meaning mean first. Three, correct. What's the average volume of a box? A box that was 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet would have a volume of 27 cubic feet. Does it follow that the average volume of these boxes is 27 cubic feet? Right? It doesn't. Is that clear to people what's happening? That if you actually do it, the first one is 1 cubic feet, then 2 by 2 is 8, 3 by 3 is 27, and so forth. That's 45 cubic feet, which is not equal to 27. And that's sort of the first example of something we'll see several times, that sometimes how things look depends on what version of a characteristic you look at, as it were. If you say, what's the average size of a box? That doesn't tell us whether you're averaging linear dimensions or volumes. And either because you wanted to persuade people of something, you might choose one or the other, or you might just say, well, you know, here are these numbers, so they average the size of the boxes, so that tells me what the average box is, so therefore in deciding how many boxes we need to put our stuff in, we can use that average, and we get the wrong answer, because we'd be using 27 instead of 45 cubic feet. Makes the distinction make sense? So, what about median? What's the median? Suppose we use average to move median. What is then the average dimension, height, width, and depth of the box?
Three,
correct. And and the volume of that would be 3 times 3 times 3, which is 27. And what is the median volume of the boxes? Also 27, right? Same box. So in that case, the median has a different, and indeed in a sense a more consistent result. So what are some of the differences? I'm just running some of the obvious ones. That the mean, as in that example, depends on how we measure the variable. Whereas, as long as all the different measurements have the same average, have to have the same order, as long as it's still the case that what is bigger this way is also bigger in volume, then the median isn't going to be affected. It'll be the same box that's median, whether we measure it by the dimensions or by the volume. Right. Now, of course, if the boxes weren't cubic, then it would matter whether we ordered them by height, by width, or by depth. That would be a further complication. But one of the features of the median that's both an advantage and a disadvantage is that it ignores how far off things are. It looks at the order. So if you consider my two income distributions, you would, I think, probably say that B, which is more interesting, A or B? Which is a more interesting fact about the mean or the median? If you're asking, what we're really asking is, which of those is the more attractive society? You're thinking about taking a job, and you maybe had equal probabilities for something of any of those salaries. You're thinking of moving to a country, or you want to know, is this country richer than that country? And maybe these millions of people or something, if you want to think of countries. And then the question is, which is more informative for those distributions, the mean or the median? In particular, if the question you're asking is A or B better? Which measure is more useful, would you say? Mean, right? Because median tells us that A is better, but in fact, A is a tiny bit better for the first two people, and B hugely better for the third person. And that's an interesting fact that you have a noticeable chance of being any of those people saying. On the other hand, as I'm pointing out, means are much more sensitive to outliers. So you can easily enough imagine, if you're doing real-world statistical work, that someone misplaces a decimal point, and some number ends up 1,000 times as big as it should have been. That could have a very large effect on your mean, which is completely bogus. Yes, my example here is setting the decimal point by 1, but doesn't affect the median. Or it could affect the media a little bit, with jumping from below to above, say, or above to below, but not very much. And then finally, consider the fact that in some cases, there really isn't a quantitative measure. Anybody know how chess players are ranked? It's quite neat, because unlike, say, bridge, it really is a measure of ability. The way chess rankings work is an equilibrium system, in which I don't know how you get your original rank, something low. But then when you play in an official tournament, if you beat somebody who is at or above your ranking goes up and his goes down. And the more he was above your ranking to start with, the more yours goes up and his goes down. And you just keep doing that for years, and the result is that pretty nearly the order of the ranking says who can beat whom. It's not permanently, of course, because it maybe A can beat B, and B can beat C, and C can beat A. There are intransitivities in most games, but roughly speaking, it is. Right? Now, suppose you have these rankings. They give you pretty accurate information about who is better than whom, but those by themselves don't really tell you how much better. All right? If you change the system in a way which sort of stretched out the upper levels so that each point in the above something became 5 points. So give you the same information, the same ordering, but mean statements about the mean would change. So that from that standpoint, if you have such orderings, median may be a more useful measure. If you say he's the median chess player, he can beat half the tourney players, and half the tourney players can beat him, roughly speaking, or at least the serious rated players. All right, does that make sense so far? Yes, no, maybe. Histograms. How many of you here already know what histogram is? Most of you. All right, so I won't spend very much time on it. But histogram is basically showing frequency. It's a graph of a frequency of something. Do I actually have a usable marker today? This claims to be a dry erase marker. I don't know if it's true or not, but we'll find out.
So the typical histogram, you've got something, suppose we're looking at height, and suppose this is 5 feet, and this is 7 feet, and this is 6 feet, and the question is, in some population, how many people are between 5 feet and 5 foot and 5 foot 1 inch, 5 foot 1 inch, 5 foot 2 inch, and so forth. And histogram is often shown in that kind of a shape, because you're, but really, the underlying idea, you'd like to take it down to millions of an inch, as it were, if you had a big enough population, and you would then have some sort of a frequency distribution. Probably goes a good deal farther down than that by the time you get to 7 feet and so forth, which is showing how many people there are. For the mathematical inclined, it's really a density function, but showing how common these different things are. All right, that's a histogram. And again, as what I was saying with means and medians, what it looks like depends a good deal on what you choose to measure. So that if I go back to my boxes, if imagine that what we want to know is, of all the boxes produced by the cardboard box industry in the U.S., what are the most common dimensions, essentially? Some question along those lines. Well, if we measure it by the edge size, then, and suppose by good luck all boxes are cubic in this world, which makes life much easier, so we could ask how many boxes have linear dimension between 0 and 1, between 1 and 2, between 2 and 3, and so forth. All right, and you could then get a histogram. And let us suppose you discovered on the basis of that histogram that the most common box size was 2 feet by side. If you did the same thing with volumes, it isn't just that this number would be 8 instead of 2. The peak wouldn't be over 8, probably. Because what are we doing? We're taking the number within some interval. But intervals defined by edge size are not the same thing as intervals defined by volume, which is the cube of edge size. Does that, again, make much of anything that's obvious or that's opaque? But if you imagine, let's suppose we do the same kind of thing, only this time we're going to do it by volume. So that's volume of 1 cubic foot, volume of 2 cubic feet, volume of 3, volume of 4, volume of 5. Well, the distance from 1 to 2 on the edge covers the whole range from 1 to 4 here. All right? Going to have lots more people in it. From 2 to 3 covers the whole range from 4 to 9 here. So therefore, how many are in effect, we're counting boxes in boxes, if you like. We're counting, we're classifying boxes by, are they within this range of sizes, this range of sizes, this range. But the ranges don't correspond if we're comparing one histogram using equal ranges of side edge with a different using equal ranges of volume. And consequently, you would end up with something where the peak would almost certainly be above 8, which is what corresponds to 2 there, because of the fact that as you're moving right on this, the length of area on this scale goes into one unit of this becoming bigger and bigger. In one sense, the bottom line of this is only that you ought to realize that what graphs show depends a whole lot on how you choose to calculate them and present them. But it's clearer, I think, if you actually understand the particular example. Yes? No? Maybe? Can't tell. All right. If you have questions, ask questions. Otherwise, I am entitled to assume you understand everything, right? It will be disillusioned in the final exam. Yes?
Can you repeat one more time why, if the most common box, the 2x2x2, doesn't necessarily...
Because remember that what we're really talking about is not a 2x2x2, but something like between a 2x2x2 and a 2+1 inch by 2+1 inch by 2+1 inch. Right? We're talking about, if this was a random distribution and there was a finite number of boxes, there would probably be no 2x2x2 boxes. Right, because that's like one point on a line. All right, but there will be some number of boxes between, suppose I say between 1.9 and 2.1. Suppose I'm taking 0.2 foot intervals. So this height shows me how boxes, many boxes between 1.9 and 2.1, between 2.1 and 2.3, 2.3 and 2.5, and so forth. Does that make sense? sorry. But the point is that he, in comparing this height to this height, I'm comparing the number between 1.9 and 2.1 with the number between 2.9 and 3.1. Those are intervals of a particular length. But those intervals are going to translate into different lengths when we look at volumes, because the volumes are the cubes of those numbers. All right? So the result is that even if it's true that there are more in this interval than in this interval here, there might be more in... Actually, I guess it would be fewer in that case. It goes either way. But there will be a different number. I should have thought this through more carefully before I gave the example. I think I've just gotten it upside down, but that's all right. But that this 1.9 to 2.1 is an interval like that here, and this interval is an interval like that here. All right? So yeah, I got it backwards. So that means that the number of people in this interval is being stretched out over this, which makes it look lower because we're talking about the number in the box, and the number here is being stretched out over that longer amount. So the relative heights are going to be different because in one case you are measuring between... In one case, each height represents how many there are in an interval of length, and in the other, in an interval of volume, and those don't map one to each other. All right. So, anyway, if you actually drew the two histograms, maybe if we were spending the whole semester on statistics, or maybe if this was a somewhat lower level course where people did more actual stuff with pencils and stuff, it might actually be fun to take a distribution of boxes, graph both histograms, and see for yourself how they came out. You could do that for your own reason if you like. So, this is running through what I just said. So, therefore, the how you measure the result may make a sizable difference in what it appears to tell you. So let me take why it matters. Is this box unusually big? Well, it could mean, is it longer than average or a larger volume or bigger than the median? And if you want, for some reason, to argue that the box is unusually big for... You can exercise your own imagination on a court case where that question could somehow come up, you would be inclined to pick that measure by which it looked relatively biggest, and if you wanted the opposite result, the opposite. My one there is Smith has worse than average name recognition. In that example, he has the median name recognition, but there is somebody in the sample, namely the president, this was written some years ago originally, I assume that's when I wrote it, who has a much, much higher name recognition. Everybody else, that pulls up the average, but only has a small effect on it. Pulls up the mean, but shouldn't say average, because it could mean either. Pulls up the mean, but only has a small effect on it. Right. And a further point, which is really going beyond this, and that is that the answer often depends on the question, and therefore, when you sum it up as name recognition, you can often bias the result according to what the question is you use to measure name recognition. And then, as I say, what... But if you think about those two, there are some purposes. If you want to know, we've got a system of reservoirs, we've got a certain amount of water that we're using, how likely is it the reservoirs will run dry? Then the important question is, what is the average rainfall this year compared to last year? On the other hand, if you are trying to decide how good a market this is for picnic things, for picnic tables maybe, the question of how many days there are with really heavy rain might be relevant, or for umbrellas might be a better example. All right. So going back
to the question of summing up your data versus using a histogram, if we really took the case where half the boxes were 3-foot boxes,
that's going to show up almost any way we graph it, all right, as a spike.
But if you want more detailed questions, such as are the number of boxes increasing or decreasing as the size goes up in range, then maybe you were actually thinking of some kind of antitrust case, and the question is, how does the number of firms vary with size, something like that. Now it might matter a good deal as to just how you define size, the equivalent of my dimension versus volume. The other thing on the histogram, the consistent pattern when I look at my student evaluations, they tend to be double-peaked. I tend to have situations where there's one group of students who evaluate very high and one very low. And that's useful information. I have not done an adequate job of using that information, which is why the lower peak is still there, because I haven't really figured out how to do a really good job of... This is across lots of classes, not this class in particular. This is an experience over 30 years or so. I haven't done an adequately good job of figuring out how to teach to the whole range of student abilities, knowledge, and so forth. But that's itself interesting. It's a different kind of information than what I would get if it was single-peaked in the middle, say. All right, single-peaked in the middle says you ought to do a better job. Double-peaked says you're doing just fine job with your A students, but you're not doing so good a job with the students who, for whatever reason, are finding this course particularly hard. And that's useful information. And I have an example down there. Do you see... what is wrong with the last line of that particular dialogue?
Yeah?
You're not sure how many female employees you have to start.
That's right. And in particular, since the first thing implies that you have more men than women, that's presumably what they're suing you for, therefore the 10-3 is really not very informative. All right. To take the real-world example of this, which I have in fact seen, there are arguments in the whole controversy pro and anti-homosexuality about whether gay men are a particular danger for child abuse. And if you're arguing that they aren't, you say, look, of all of the cases of child abuse, only, let me make up a number, 20% involve gay men. And of course, you're arguing, yes, but what percentage of people are gay men? Those would be two different ways of making the same argument, which would get strikingly different effects, and which, according to which side of the argument you were trying to make, would determine how you would be inclined to put it. All right? Is that? So, let's take my real-world example of this sort of thing. I don't remember where I got it, but presumably about 2008 or 2009. I think these are my 2009 PowerPoints. While a number of factors have helped lower the rate, it is our experience that public education coupled with and so forth and so on also contributing. And so the question is, suppose you actually want to know what you should do to keep down highway rates or anything else. That is, the regulated insurance company is not how do you keep it down, it's are they down by how much, and so forth and so on. So then some of the questions you might ask, what are other possible reasons why? In fact, what's the first question you should ask just about the statistic? Auto death rates per capita are record low, 9% below the rate for 2007. What's one possible reason why the death rate per capita? Whenever somebody says a rate, all right, a rate is the ratio of something to something. It's nice to know what the two things are. Per capita, the two together, one of the things is a head. That's what capita literally means. So this means that they don't even say whether per capita is drivers or not. That might mean that the number of people who died on the highway divided by the population of the U.S. has gone down by 9%. It might mean the number of licensed drivers, the number of people died on the highway divided by the number of licensed drivers has gone down by 9%. They would like to know which it is, because it might be that what's going on is that the fraction of the population that's licensed drivers is changing. What would be another very obvious thing that they aren't taking account of there that
is relevant to, in one sense, that's the rate. Or putting it like, what's the other thing you might add? One of them is the rate per driver, say. What's the other thing you might ask for the rate for? Yeah?
I want to know what the driving conditions are in the years.
That would be an interesting, in terms of, you're right, but in terms of explaining what's going on, one interesting question would be, for example, did the weather change?
All right.
So, yeah?
Would you be interested in the rate per car? With respect to, it would shift from individual drivers to mass transit, therefore one aspect of the bus could result in more
autos. I see, that's interesting. Yeah, I think they're saying autos, so they're probably not counting buses. You certainly imagine doing it in that form that you might ask. I was really thinking of the denominator, but for the numerator, you might want to put it, actually, it's death rates, so the answer is it's death rates. But accident rates and death rates might give you different answers. In particular, either suppose you had a shift toward more people per car, which you might easily have under some circumstances, then it might be the accident rate went down and the death rate went up. Alternatively, suppose medicine is improving. Accident rate could go up and the death rate could go down. All right, so all of those things, in thinking about the cause, it's worth knowing what these rates are. Now, what I was thinking of was the rate per mile. Because after all, suppose what happened, as in fact I think it is, I'd have to look at the numbers, but let me suppose that 2008 was a high gas price year. I don't remember anymore the exact pattern, but I probably knew when I wrote that slide. But suppose the gas prices were a whole lot higher in 2008 than in 2007. One result of high gas prices is people drive less. So you could have a drop in death rates per capita that was entirely due to the people driving less rather than due to cars being safer or drivers being safer or any of those things. So that would be one of the first things you'd want to look at is what is the number if you look at it per mile. Let me take a very different case, not the question of causation. Which are safer, airplanes or cars? What would you like to know in answering that question? Anybody? Really? Is that what you want to know? Not what I want to know. That'll tell you how scared you should feel. But it won't tell you which you should take, because it takes the airplane roughly 5 hours to do what takes the car 80 hours, or you know, whatever it takes to drive from one coast to the other, 50 hours maybe. So if I'm trying to decide, should I drive across the country or should I fly, for that kind of thing, the question is going to be death rate per mile, isn't it? Am I wrong? Disagree? You're entitled to defend your answer. No. Yeah?
I want to know death per trip. Regardless of...
Why do you want to know that? Why is that interesting?
Because I might choose to drive longer or go to a different location than if I flew.
But you're certainly not going to fly to the supermarket when you go shopping. And that's a lot of your trips are that, driving, you know, commuting to work and such, you'd never fly. So it seems to me that the relevant question is comparing comparable trips, which is going to mean the kind of trip for which you could drive for a day or fly for 2 hours kind of thing. So no, if all you want to know is how scared I should feel, or if you want to know how careful should I be to write my will before doing this, or that kind of question, then per hour or per trip might be perfectly reasonable. But if you're trying to decide which is safer, to get to such and such a place by flying or to get to such and such a place by driving, then it seems to me it's the per mile that matters. Yeah? Because airplanes move much faster than cars.
But if you're concerned about dying or not dying?
And I'm deciding whether to drive to Pitt from here to Pittsburgh or fly from here to Pittsburgh. And flying from here to Pittsburgh will take about four hours, and driving from here to Pittsburgh is 4 days at about 9 hours, it's about 36 or 40 hours. No, more than that, I'm sorry, I forgot the fifth day. So call it 5 hours versus 50 hours, just to make it easy. Well, even if my chance of dying per hour is twice as high in the airplane, my chance of dying is much lower if I fly than if I drive, because the driving is going to be 10 times as long.
I guess I was just trying to figure out how that data set works, because I guess you easily get the airline travel. So if you're in a car, you want to know how many people in a car die during that trip, but it would also be important to know how many people die from point A to subpoint B and all the distances in between.
That would be useful if you wanted to evaluate different highways and such, certainly. But if you wanted a total summary number, all you really have to know is some measure of miles driven, which presumably there's going to be some evidence for from gas consumption and things like that, maybe some polling data versus total highway deaths. Right? I mean, certainly, it's almost always true that you could imagine higher quality versions of the same data you're looking at. And I'm really focusing less than what you could do if you knew more than about different things you might want to know. And as I say, and if you go back to this one, so a lot of the questions you'd like to ask for that first one are in order to decide any of these things are what other reasons might there be? For example, gas is more because people are driving less, medical care is improved, and therefore accidents are less often fatal. The number of people in a car has gone down for some reason, and therefore a single accident kills fewer people. That's death rates, right? So, somebody was going to say something. All right. So all I'm saying is that the question you'd like to ask, the person, whoever wrote this, presumably has his own opinions, which may or may not be based on the data, right? For all you know, this is someone who, before he looked at the data, said, aha, we've been working really hard to get auto death rates down. Here are the important factors. Let's see. Aha, we're successful. So you don't know without knowing a lot more than he tells you whether the data actually show that. You could, after all, look at the question of are there states that had public education on driving programs? Did their death rate go down more than other states? And similarly for lots of other things. Is it clear, by the way, that making cars safer will reduce either accident rates or death rates? Yeah? I would have said that it will almost certainly have... Well, it doesn't mean by safer. But safer means you don't get hurt as much in an accident for a moment, as opposed to safer means your brakes work better. Let me distinguish them. So let me take a particular thing to seatbelt laws and airbags and stuff like that. As an economist, my expectation is that requiring those things will increase the accident rate and might decrease or increase the death rate. Because after all, accidents don't just happen. Accidents are a consequence of decisions made by the driver. You decide how fast to drive, how often to drive, whether you drive and you've had a drink or two, things like that, how much pay attention to driving, and so forth. The safer the car is, the less the incentive is to take precautions. All right. Somewhere or other, I think Larry Niven has a short story, science fiction story, some point in the future, with this air car, which is just sort of super safe, and it ends up being swallowed by a gigantic bird on some planet or other, and 6 months later, for various reasons, it doesn't get out, and the bird dies, and 6 months later, the bird's carcass rots, and the occupant of the car, still alive, fed with the air provided by this very, very safe car, goes off, and I think he tries to steal a car company that they should have had some provision for getting out of giant birds when eaten by. And the implication there is that such a rich and advanced society that they can have an incredible level of safety. Suppose we had that. Suppose you had a car where you knew that if you were in an accident, the chance of dying was essentially zero. You wouldn't drive as carefully as you do now, I don't think. I wouldn't, at least. Yeah? If you're correct that if the result was it was also more as expensive as a result, then you indeed might. But I was imagining that all we're changing is the safety of it. Yeah?
I think that's what you might answer the car. The car tells you to start drifting.
Yeah. There's actually data on this, I should say. There's a classic article in the literature by Sam Peltzman who analyzed the effect of legal rules, I think requiring safety belts and some other, I think maybe it was collapsing steering wheels, but a number of things, but all of which were basically reducing the chance of being injured when an accident occurred. And his conclusion was that the increase in the accident rate roughly balanced the decrease in the death per accident effect, so the actual number of deaths wasn't much changed.
my memory, in fact, is that he found that there was a statistically insignificant, that's small enough that it could have been by chance, decrease in deaths to occupants of cars and a roughly equal statistically insignificant increase in deaths to pedestrians. Because, of course, the seatbelt doesn't protect a pedestrian, and if the driver drives a little faster, he's a little more likely to run into a pedestrian. But that's just a point. I mean, part of what I'm really saying there is that although on the one hand you need to have guesses of what's going on in order to make sense of data, you also have to be willing to consider that your guess might be entirely wrong. So that it seems on the face of it that as prior to Peltzman's work, the standard report was these safety improvements have saved X lives. How was it calculated? Well, it was calculated by taking data on deaths per accident, taking the actual number of accidents, and saying that the result of putting in these improvements was that the number of deaths per accident went down from 0.1 to 0.09. That's a saving of 0.01. Multiply that by the number of accidents, that's how many lives we saved. And then you get a different answer if the question you asked is, how did the number of deaths change after these things went in? And the answer is, after allowing for lots of other factors, it didn't really go.
Institutional state safety measures increases the safety measures, but decreases the amount of care people take.
Yep.
Could you use those multiple data points to calculate an objective figure for how much people value driving?
If you had a way of measuring the cost of care.
Yeah.
That would be the problem. That is, a lot of the care is paying attention, so it would be hard to price that. But in principle, you could, sure. I should say that an economist at the same time will seem sort of hard-hearted in saying that insisting on seatbelts may not save lives, but then the economist will turn around and say, but by the way, even if it doesn't save lives, it might be a good thing, because after all, getting home faster is a good thing. So that if you imagine the person who just about balances the extra safety with faster driving, he's getting a benefit from that. He's getting to drive faster, which is a good reason to want to do. He's getting a cost, it's true. But if the total number of deaths is the same as before they put in the seatbelts, then on net, he's got the same cost there and the extra benefit. It's just he's chosen to take the benefit in faster driving rather than taking the benefit in lower risk of death. So, or some mixture of those. Anyway, so we haven't really gotten into real statistics yet. We'll be doing that in a little bit. But I'm trying to give some idea of the kind of questions you have to ask. That, you know, somebody says, facts don't speak for themselves. All right? Somebody else said, I think, if you torture the data long enough, it'll always confess. So you have to think about this issue of how do you get from looking at facts to conclusions. So what are the suggestions for the decline in auto rates? What are the possible reasons? People are driving less. There are fewer cars, people in each car. Medical care has improved. None of those, I think, were listed in the original story. Or people are making cars safer. Or people are more conscious of safe driving. Or we've put in lower speed limits, and for some reason people are obeying them. You can think of a whole lot of different possible reasons. And then for each of them, you would want to think about, if it's true, how would we find out? What predictions come from this? Let me give you an example I came across. It had nothing to do with cars, but I thought it was a very neat example of using what we think of as natural experiments. And this had to do with language acquisition, that there's a good deal of evidence that above some age, it is very hard to really learn a second language well. So that, roughly speaking, most people who have learned a second language as an adult will always speak it with an accent. Whereas most people who have learned a second language when they were five will sound like native speakers. And so somebody wanted to do a test of this. And his test started out with the fact that the West Indies consists of a bunch of vaguely similar islands, in some of which the local language is English and in some of which it isn't. People migrate to the U.S. from the West Indies. Somehow they got data on age of migration and how well you eventually did. I don't know what the measure was, income or something as an adult, something like that. And it turned out that if you migrated younger than, I think, 13, people who came from English-speaking islands did no better on average than people who came from non-English-speaking islands. Whereas if you migrated older than about 13, people from English-speaking islands did substantially better than from non-English-speaking islands. And that was just struck me as a nice, clever example of how you use a natural experiment that's happening anyway, and you then analyze the data. If anybody wants to read Freakonomics, Freakonomics will not teach you very much economics. But what it will do is show a bunch of clever ways of taking an economist's guess and figuring out whether it's true, of looking at data. That's what, at least to my mind, what made it an interesting book. Now, I'm biased because it's a competitor of mine, and I sold many more copies than my book did, but, which was not about that, but was about economics. Anyway, so that you can think about reasons why it matters for public policy, if you believe that insisting on driver education courses in high school, making them mandatory, reduces auto death rates, that might be a reason to want to do that. You'd like to know if it's true. It might or might not be true. Similarly, if you think that stiffer driver's licensing requirements, I gather that in England, from things people say, getting a driver's license is non-trivial. I would have said that in America it's trivial. That is to say that almost nobody other than people who are blind or very old or something is unable to pass a driver's test, not necessarily the first time. And I gather that's not true anymore. This may explain something I have long found puzzling, which is why there's anybody left alive in England. Because in England, they've got narrow roads with high hedges that you can't see around with lots of bends. And you would think that even aside from the fact they drive on the wrong side of the road, which is rather confusing, that those factors would result in all of them being dead by now. But in fact, I think their highway death rate is lower than ours per mile, I believe, so I've been told. And it maybe the answer is that they are much more stringent about making sure the drivers are competent. I don't know. But that's the sort of thing you'd like to try to find out for lots of different reasons. And, of course, in terms of insurance rates, can you think about why, from a purely selfish standpoint, an insurance company might like to know what causes auto death rates? You're an actuary for an insurance company. You've just discovered that either that driver's ed courses do or that they don't reduce the auto death rate. Either one will do for whatever reason. Yeah. Sure. But let me start where I was. I was saying, why would somebody working for an insurance company want to know what were the factors that affect auto death rates? Yeah?
Because if it's a physical factor, like the type of car, the type of
driver, the traffic car, then they want to reduce their risk in that category. What they want to do is to get customers who are lower risk and avoid customers who are high risk, or if they have high risk customers, charge them a high price so that it's worth insuring them. So what I was thinking of, you can imagine either the case where insurance companies have ignored driver's ed courses. And suppose you produce good statistical evidence that kids who take driver's ed courses do better than ones who don't. And it'd be a little hard to do because, of course, the kids are probably not randomly selected. Right? You might say, well, here is a high school that has driver's ed, here's one that doesn't. Let's see how they do accident rates. But those are different high schools, and one of them may be in a slum and one of them in a suburb, and maybe the drivers in one place or the other are safer. So you have to be a little careful in evaluating your data. But suppose you discovered that driver's education really, really matter. You then say, all right, we'll offer a 5% discount to any customer who's had a driver's ed, of course. And if you believe that the auto rate, death rate goes down by, or accident rate goes down by more than 5%, you've just made money. Right, you've gotten customers who, even at a slightly lower rate, are really a better deal than your average customers. You could reverse it. Suppose all the insurance companies, being good public-spirited sorts, give a 5% discount for having taken driver's ed, but I think some do, some discount or other. And suppose you are the actuary who actually looks at the numbers and discovers it's all bogus, that those courses do no good at all. Well, the advice you're going to give your insurance company is going to be either stop giving the discount, or if that's politically unpopular, offer the discount, but do your best to discourage those people from insuring with us, because they're not really a good deal. All right. So you can see how that kind of information is useful in lots and lots of different contexts. All right, let me go on to ways of fooling people, or being fooled or not being fooled. Does that look like something that's really changed a whole lot over the period shown by the graph? Does anybody see how I've cheated on that graph? Obviously. I've only done... That's the real graph. All right? That's the one which is showing zero. You see, these are not uncommon. You'll actually see people doing this. They would say, I want to focus it in so you can see the important bit, but in the process, they're greatly exaggerating the size of the effect that they're showing. So that would be one example. That's one of my sort of how to watch this experience. Let me give you a real example. Now, I should say the numbers I'm giving are not real because I'm doing this from memory of a class that I took 50-some years ago. But I was shocked at the time, and it's still a mystery. This was from a textbook, I think, used in colleges, but I was at an elite prep school and they used fancy textbooks by two historians called Nevins and Commager, and they were discussing the events leading up to the Great Depression. And they said roughly what I quote there, except as I'm putting my memory. 1920 to 1930, farm income fell 40%. Presidents Harding and Coolidge did nothing. Before I show you sort of any graphs, what might you wonder about when they make the statement in that form? Yep?
Well, I wonder what they mean by income. They're just big dollars.
That would be one interesting question I don't remember anymore. There wasn't a lot of inflation. There was deflation in the last year of that period, roughly, but mostly I don't, and I guess at the very beginning also, actually, this is not quite right. There was deflation at the very beginning of the 20s. But that's one question to ask. Yeah?
Would you be interested in what the meaning of farm is, whether it's livestock or...
You might, but the real point they're making, the point they're trying to argue is things were getting worse and the government was ignoring it. And in particular, these two presidents who they name are ignoring. Ready? Let me show you what, by memory, the actual graph looked like. That red is stylized what was happening to farm income. At the very beginning of the 20s, you have a very sharp drop in prices. You have, in fact, what if you looked at it and closed the book in 1922, you would say the Great Depression is about to start. That, if I remember correctly, I looked up the numbers at one point. I think the change in unemployment from 20 to 21 is about the same as from 30 to 31. And various other things of that sort of happening. But it didn't happen. That one, you know, within a couple of years was all over. So you have a sharp drop in farm income roughly in the first 3 months of the term of the first of those two presidents. Farm income is then generally trending up through the rest of his term and all of the term of the second of the two presidents, because they're talking about Coolidge, not Hoover. Hoover is elected in 28. And it then drops at the beginning of the Great Depression. So the trick here is that you take the two, you pick your two endpoints in such where the line between the endpoints is sloping down. And you thus make it look as though the line in between was sloping down, whereas in this case it's down, up, down. Does that point make? And there are lots of ways you can do this trick. I'll go through another example, maybe something even a little closer to the home. This is, again, I think a real story. I may be wrong, but right. What might you wonder about that when they say that judicial salaries adjusted for inflation have fallen more than 20%? What question might occur to you over the past 10 years? Yeah?
Whether they were inflated before the 10 years?
You might ask that question. Yeah?
I don't really want to know what's happening to the rest of the economy. Like, what's the cost of goods?
You might want to know that. Let me show you what Brian Peter styled to have to look up the data, what was really happening. What was happening was that, at least at the federal level, gee, I remember this paper may have been about federal, I'm not sure, every once in a while Congress votes to raise judges' salaries. So if that's happening, since you normally have positive inflation rates, in between those once in a while, it's going down. The inflation-adjusted one is going down because prices are going gradually up. So therefore, if you, the judge who wants to persuade people that judges should get a raise, deliberately pick these 2 points, look, it looks as though we've had declining wages. Whereas if you had chosen to pick these 2 points, you would have found that it's going up. And again, I didn't look up the numbers. My point is just that was the general pattern. And it struck me as a neat example of how, by selecting your endpoints, you can get the result you want. Right. And making the same point more generally. Imagine we've got something which is going up and down. Well, if you want to say it's going down, what do? You draw your line from here to here, and those are the two. Just cite the value here and the value here. Obviously, it's going sharper than that. Yeah, well, on the other hand, you want an optimistic picture of the world, you pick this point. because there are a lot of things in the world which act like that, which go up and down. That's a trick that's quite likely to get used, and you therefore ought to be aware. Somebody says, you know, during, if someone's attacking President Obama, and he says that from this month to that month, something got worse. I don't know, unemployment, price levels, whatever you're having to be arguing about, you'd like to know where those endpoints came from. You'd like to be able to see the whole graph and see whether he's deliberately picked from a high point to a low point in order to get that effect, which is, as I say, what I think the Nevinson commentary text. The Nevinson commentary, I really was shocked, because as far as I could tell, that was professional academics who were lying to their readers. Not literally lying in that their numbers were true, but lying and implying something that did not in fact follow. Now, whether they'd ever looked at the numbers, I don't know. You know, I suspect that too many professional historians, like other people, are willing to rely on second and third hand information from other people's work, and some went back there and read those numbers. That's the trick for this, is pick your endpoints. This is a real one. Again, I don't know the exact numbers, but it's about like this. And this was after after Bush won his second election. I saw a fair number of web pages that did this. They showed 5-8 states, roughly, the numbers were the same in all of them, in 5 where the voting machines that did not generate paper trails were used, Bush did better in the election than the pre-election polls, and the other 3 he didn't. Obviously, the reason Bush won was that the Diebold people who made the voting machines were in his pocket, and they rigged the voting machines so that every 3 Democrat votes for a Democrat were only counted as 2, and every 3 votes for a Republican were counted as 4, and that's how he won. Right, what's wrong with that evidence? Putting aside whether it's true, which I have no idea. I have no inside information on Diebold's voting machines. But why is that not convincing evidence for the claim? Yep?
Because the circumstances at the pre-election poll would have been different than the circumstances at the actual election.
Well, that would have to explain it once. But after all, it isn't just that Bush always did better in the election. It's that in the ones that didn't have paper trails, which are the ones which you can fudge by having by cheating on the machine, he did better. He didn't do better in the ones where there's paper trail and therefore it wasn't safe to cheat. So it can't be sufficient, yep.
If there was 8 states that you would count 4-4 on just by chance, but 5-3 really isn't all that different.
Oh, but that point isn't 5-3. The point is that all 5 of the states that went one way, and all 3 of the states that did the other went the other. Right? It's not the distribution of whether states did or didn't use paper trails. The claim is that those states where the voting machines were set up so you couldn't cheat, Bush did about the same in the election as he did in the polls. Those states where the voting machines weren't set up to prevent cheating, he did better. That's the argument that was being made. There's quite a lot of different web pages after that election. Yep?
I just want to know how they pick the 8
states. Yeah, that's the question now. You got it. How do they pick the 8 states? Well, you can tell. It's not, once you think about it for a few, you know perfectly well how they pick the 8 states. They looked at every state, and they selected the ones that fit their theory. Right? If you had a state that had a paper trail, where Bush did better after than before, they didn't include that in their collection of 8 states. If you had a state which didn't have a paper trail, where Bush didn't do better, they didn't include that in the state. That's without having checked all 50 states. The mere fact that they only gave a small subset of the states and then made this assertion is pretty strong evidence. And in fact, there was a similar scam on the question of secondhand smoke. Now, I may be wrong, because I don't know if I've read the whole literature on this, but I believe what happened was that there was a study which claimed that the towns where they put in a rule preventing, like, smoking in restaurants, maybe it was, that immediately thereafter, hospital admissions for heart problems dropped noticeably. And they based this, they had, like, I don't know, half a dozen towns which did such things. And then somebody at the National Bureau of Economic Research redid the work with the entire sample, with all of the towns with their data. No effect. That basically, some towns it goes up, some towns it goes down, whether or not you introduce this requirement. But that piece of research let people say, aha, we've proved that even in a short period of time,
secondhand smoke must be doing damage because they prevented it, and look, they had. So that's, again, I think a fairly common trick, sometimes accidentally. That is, you may have a case where your sample is biased, not because you were trying to bias it, but because the data that happened to be available wasn't for a random selection. I think I mentioned.
Select your very non-random sample. Let me go back for just a moment, because something which we'll get to later, but I should mention, you know the famous case of why, I guess it was Truman, was predicted to lose the 1948 election. Pretty sure it was 48, which he won. Telephone poll. All right, some polling organization did a poll calling people up and asked who they vote for, and they concluded that I think Dewey was the Republican candidate who was going to win the election. Why was that the wrong answer? Because only relatively well-off people, and only would be an exaggeration, but because the sample of people with telephones was a highly non-random sample, and it was biased in a way which resulted in more Republicans and fewer Democrats than populists. Oh, that's right. That's the natural theory. In the famous real world. All right, let's go to another characteristic of your distribution, which is its dispersion. That there is a big difference between a population where everybody's height is between 5'6" and 5'8", and a population with the same average where they go from 4 feet to 7 feet. All right, so you'd like to have measures of how wide your spread is, and similarly for lots of and lots of individuals. And the way in which that is usually defined is by something called standard deviation. Again, how many of you here could tell me what a standard deviation is? All right, so most of you, I'm not wasting my time explaining. We'd like a sort of a measure of, on average, how far from the average it is. Well, if we just said, all right, average is 5'6", I'm 5'3.5", so that's minus 2.5 from the average. Add all of those up for everybody, you would get zero. Because, of course, if I'm below, someone else is above, that's why the average is where it is. Add them all up with a little bit of algebra, we'll say you become zero. So what you do instead is you square the deviations, which make all of them positive and other useful things. So that what you do is you take the, let me take height. Let's call, if you can read this, the green one is the only one I've so far found, unless there's another one hiding here somewhere. Which there probably is not. So let HI be the height of the ith person, the first person, the second person, the third person, etc., that you're looking at, and let H bar be the average height for the whole population. So what you do is you take HI minus H bar squared. You take the average of that, so that means the sum over everybody divided by the number of people. So you take, for the non-mathematicians, sigma means the sum over I. That means you're adding up the value of this for person 1 plus the value of person 2 plus the value of person 3 and so forth, and dividing it by N, which is the number of people. And that's the formal definition of the standard deviation. And that then, yeah?
For purposes of the final rule, it requires to know how to calculate it.
I do not think you will be expected to calculate it, but you would expect to have some idea of what it is.
Sure.
Because you may, I don't know what I have on the standard, if I remember my past exams, you might have a question which is of the form, here is a report on an experiment where the standard deviation of such and such was such and such. Is this good evidence that such and such is true?
We don't need to calculate the
data. I do not expect you to, no. I don't think you're going to have time to do that. If you did, you'd be doing it on a calculator anyway. Computer, if we could use computers. So that's that's the definition. It turns out that there's a simple rule which applies to all distributions, not just normal distributions, and that is that at least 3/4 of the points are within 2 standard deviations of the mean.
And if you spend a little time with paper and pencil, you may be able to figure out why that's true. What you basically do is to say, if I was trying to construct my distribution to get as many points as, to get as few points as possible within two standard deviations, what would I do? And the answer is all your points would either be at the zero in order to keep at the mean to keep standard deviation, or just at that two standard deviation line. And when you draw it up that way, you will work out that the most you can do is to get it down to 25% outside and 75% inside. But anyway, but it's just a useful rule. I wouldn't expect you to memorize that either, but you might want to if you're going to have to deal with these things. And at least 89% are within three standard deviations. All right? That being, what, 8/9, I think, versus 3/4. So I will let, if algebra amuses you, I will let you, as an exercise for yourself, see if you can prove that to your own satisfaction, but it's not very important, so I'm not going to. All right, so-called normal distribution that you've probably all heard of, alias the bell curve, and it is a particular shape of a distribution such that if somebody tells you what the mean of the distribution is and what the standard deviation, that fully defines the distribution. All right, it turns out that many real-world distributions approximate it, many don't, of course, and it also turns out that if you do that, the distribution of the average of many samples from the same population tends to a normal. That's complicated. Let me say that there are certain ways in which you can work with data which you can expect will usually give you something close to a normal distribution. That's probably as close as possible. And where you have a normal distribution, there are certain, again, I wouldn't expect you to memorize this, but you ought to know that the normal distribution is such that there will be some certain fraction which you don't have to remember within one standard deviation, within two standard deviations, and so forth. What you will probably, what I think I will be wanting, might want you to, I don't know if it'll be on the exam, but it could be on the exam, which we'll get to a good deal later, is the use of the Z table, which is basically how you calculate how likely it is that something is more than 3.5 standard deviations away from the mean, say. So it's just a table of those numbers. You just look it up on the table. If we do it, I'll give you the table. But we'll see if that, how much that comes up. So basically, Z is the number of standard deviations from the mean, and the table tells you how likely it is that an actual thing in the distribution will be there. So if I say, for example, that the average height is 5'6", if it were a normal distribution, which I'm sure it's not, and I then say, how likely is it that somebody at random, and the standard deviation is 3 inches, how likely is it that a random person will be more than 6 feet? Well, that's two standard deviations from the mean. You would look up on the Z table and see what the Z number was for 2, and that would tell you how likely it was that somebody would be at least 2 standard deviations above the mean. We'll get to that more later. One distinction that's worth making in the last few minutes is between the sample statistic and the population statistic. So let me go back here. And here my sum was over the whole population. So imagine that the population is law students at Santa Clara. And if one had the data for all of them, you could find out what their mean height was and what the standard deviation of that height was. All right? But you're very unlikely to have the data for all of them. So what you're normally doing is you're taking a sample. You're picking, hopefully at random, 40 students. And you say, what is their average height? That gives us an estimate of the average height of the population, not a perfect one. And what is the standard deviation? And if you think about it for a few minutes, you will see that if you use the same formula for the sample that we're going to use for the population, you'll get the wrong answer. Why is that the case? Suppose the sample size is 1. We're just going to look at me, picked at random. Well, for that sample, I can tell you H-bar, if I haven't shrunk recently, is 5 feet, 3.5 inches. Sorry, 3.5 inches. For that, if we just looked at that sample, what's the standard deviation? How far am I from the mean of my one-person sample? Anybody? Zero, of course, right? that I am the mean of my one person theorem. So therefore, if I use this formula, I would say, well, h I'm an h bar is 0, n is 1, standard deviation is 0. It's a perfectly tight distribution. Everybody in Santa Clara is 5 foot 3 and a half inches. Who would have thought it? All right. What's wrong, if you think about it logically, is that not only for a sample of 1, but for any sample, insofar as the sample is off average, so is its mean in the same direction. So therefore, the standard deviation will always look a little smaller than it should be, in this case a lot smaller than it should be, because we're measuring for the sample the standard deviation from the sample mean, not from the real mean. And if the sample happens to be a little high, the sample mean is going to be a little high, making the deviation look smaller. It turns out that the solution to that, for reasons which I can't explain because I don't know them, I don't know if I ever knew them, maybe I once did, is that you divide by n minus 1 instead of n, when you're estimating the standard deviation of the population using the numbers for the sample. So that tells you you can't get anything at all when there's one person trying to divide by 0, and you've got 0 divided by 0. But once you get beyond one person, that's a way of compensating for the effect I just described and gives you an estimate of the standard deviation of the population which your sample is drawn from. All right. So that finishes that, and I think we are just out of time, and so I can go have a late lunch or something. And you might see if you have any questions from the book, because at this point I'm working mostly from my notes, and if there are things in the book that you find puzzling, ask me about them. All right. I don't remember. I have to look. Oh, is it a probability? Talks about that at some point. I haven't gotten that far. That might be. I don't know. Yeah, because something I will be talking about, because something people almost always misunderstand, is what confidence measures are about. When you say at the P.05 level we've confirmed this, that may be what you're thinking of. And what people think that's saying is how likely is it that my theory is true. So if I claim that driver's ed courses reduce accident rates, and if I say, here are the data, and they show at the 0.05 level, right? People think what that means is that there's only a 1 chance in 20 that they don't really reduce accident rates. But in fact, that's not what it means at all. What it really means is if they don't reduce accident rates, there's only 1 chance in 20 that the data would come out as strongly to show that they do as it did. So it's a statement not about the probability of your theory given the data, but about the probability of having gotten those data if your theory is wrong.
Explain to me why those are different things.
Let me give you my standard example. And that is, let me show you. That's why it's so easy to confuse them. And the wrong one is the one people want to know, which is why it's okay. I pull a coin out of my pocket. My hypothesis is this is a double-headed coin. I could look at it, but that would be cheating. I flip it twice. Comes heads both times. If it's a fair coin, what is the probability that it will come up heads twice?
1 in 4.
Correct. So does that mean that the probability that it is not a double-headed coin is only 1 in 4? If it is, we could have an interesting series of bets on the third flip, right?
Well, I mean, yes.
No, it doesn't, because you in fact have some additional information which is relevant, which you would need to actually calculate it, and that is that almost no coins are double-headed. Right? If you had real numbers, suppose you knew that 1 coin in 1,000,000 was double-headed, you would then say there are 2 possibilities. One of them is that I pulled a fair coin out of my pocket, almost a dead certainty, 999,999 out of 1,000,000. And I then made a 1 in 4 chance by rolling 2 heads. The probability that had is about 1 in 4 minus a tiny, tiny bit. The other possibility is that I pulled a double-headed coin out of my pocket and got two heads. Probability of one-headed coin, one in a million. Probability of two heads with a double-headed coin? That's sure. Sure thing. So the first thing has a probability of just under a quarter, and the other has a probability of one in a million, which is more likely to have happened. This is a sketch of what's called Bayesian probability theory or Bayesian statistics, which is trying to use that. So without what's called the prior probability, the estimate before you did the experiment of how likely the theory was, you can't get how likely it is after, because you don't know if what happened is that you started out with a null hypothesis, the alternative to your hypothesis, which is in this case it's fair coin, which was very, very likely, and then a somewhat unlikely sequence of events after that. So that's a well, but I'll be discussing that at much greater length later, because it's a fairly important kind of statement.